Hilda Thomas appealed to students to fight a new law on abortion at a rally held today outside the sub-entrance of UBC. As president of the board of directors of the Every Woman's Health Clinic and as a leading member of the BC Coalition for Abortion Clinics, Hilda Thomas is spearheading the movement to fight any future law restricting access to abortions. This future law is expected to be handed down soon by a federal parliament that just recently convened for its fall session. Currently, Canada is without any law restricting access to abortion. According to Thomas, this free state of affairs contrasts sharply with the harsh realities women faced only decades ago.
Now, women of my generation started fighting around the issue of choice way back in 1968 when the abortion caravan, that famous women's cross-country caravan, started out from Vancouver to go to Parliament to demand the right of women to choose abortion if that was their decision. They went to Parliament carrying a coffin which they deposited on the Prime Minister's lawn. They then went to the Parliament buildings where some of them got dressed up in secondhand clothes so they would look like ladies and chained themselves to the railing in the gallery of the Parliament buildings, demanding that something be done to change the abortion laws in this country.
In response to the demands by women and women's groups, a new abortion law allowed therapeutic abortions on the recommendations of a doctor and a hospital committee. It was known as Section 251 of the Criminal Code, and under it, only 25% of Canadian hospitals actually performed abortions. It empowered committees to refuse requests from women for abortions and, according to Thomas, it rejected and ignored the rights of women. In January of 1988, the Supreme Court of Canada overturned Section 251 of the Criminal Code after a long legal battle waged by Dr. Henry Morgenthaler.
I'm sure a lot of you know about Henry Morgenthaler, his clinics in Montreal, the fact that he was tried and acquitted and tried and acquitted again and tried again and jailed and acquitted on appeal and finally took the case to the Supreme Court, which in January 1988 overturned Section 251 of the Criminal Code and said that women had a right to access to abortion across the country.
This decision legalized abortions and the clinics in which they were being performed by totally decriminalizing the practice. Thus, since 1988, there have been no new laws controlling or limiting abortions in any way, and for over a year and a half, women have had unrestricted access to abortions. While the federal and provincial governments have fumbled over and avoided the controversial issue up to now, it is expected that this fall session of Parliament will produce a new law on abortion.
We have heard rumors that this law is going to put gestational limits after the first trimester, which would mean after 12 weeks, women would have to start jumping through those medical and legal hoops again before they could get an abortion.
To Hilda Thomas, a new law on abortion would constitute a direct threat to the rights of women. Not a new law, but a new government funding of abortion clinics and programs to prevent unwanted pregnancies is her appeal. She notes that 10% of the women who come to the Every Woman's Health Clinic decide against an abortion, and that only 0.5% of abortions in Canada are performed after the 20-week gestation mark, usually in response to discovering that the fetus is severely genetically disformed in some way. Thus, Thomas claims there is no need to set a legal ceiling on the gestation time of abortions.
It is a campaign that says that women are not capable of making free, responsible, ethical choices. It's a disinformation campaign because it paints women as irresponsible and wicked creatures who will go out at 6 or 7 or 8 or even 9 months of pregnancy and decide on the basis of a whim to have an abortion. The notion of a full-grown fetus being aborted at a late third trimester stage is absolutely appalling and false notion. In fact, no woman will choose abortion lately. Any woman who chooses a second-term abortion is doing so only because of the most profound reasons.
As part of the Canadian-wide protest movement against any new law restricting abortions, a pro-choice day of action slated for Saturday, October 14th, is being sponsored by the BC Coalition for Abortion Clinics. In Vancouver, a march beginning at 11 o'clock at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre Plaza will end in a rally at 1 o'clock at Sunset Beach.
There may always be a need for abortion. We don't have adequate birth control. Some women can't take the pill. Some women are scared to death of the IUD for very good reasons. Women's bodies have been used to experiment on for things like those high estrogen birth control pills and the IUD that produced infertility and even death in some women. No other form of birth control is in fact 100% safe. So women may from time to time find themselves pregnant when they don't want to be pregnant, and in that situation, women have a right to choose, and we don't need any law. We don't need policemen breathing down their necks to tell them what to do with their own bodies. Woo!
For CITR, my name is Catherine Vogt.
No, what one can really see is that the West Germans are receiving them with open arms. It seems for me very often that a lot of West Germans, for the first time in their life, discover that there is another Germany, and that those young people coming from there are the same.
Just a question about the people that are going over. Now, we were talking during the speech about how they're basically more well-to-do people with their established lives. What about the role of the students in East Germany, the younger people coming over? Are there younger people going over, and, or if they're staying in East Germany, do they feel that they can change things in that country?
What we can see is that relatively few academics, relatively few students were coming now, but skilled people from the middle ranks, let's say skilled workers, engineers, people of the technical intelligence, and this is a very bad sign for the Eastern system. When those people go out, it is really becoming dangerous for them, because you can replace people at the Faculty of Arts, but you can't replace an engineer at a power plant.
You mentioned that West Germany is obviously a very small country. It's smaller than the state of Oregon. They're receiving all of these refugees from East Germany, and West Germany has said that they will accept as many people as are willing to come. Do you think there will be a point where West Germany can simply not accept any more people for lack of room or lack of jobs or whatever?
It is not thinkable, because that is part of our constitution, that as we are in the position of the successor of the old German Reich, we have to accept every German whether we like it or not. But of course, when there is not a solution, the day could come where we had to say that we can't accept any longer refugees. But in practice, we can't.
Do you think that point will come?
No, it can't come very soon. Again, you have to consider certain figures, certain factors. West Germany has nearly 16 million inhabitants, and we are having now from East Germany under 200,000 per year. So this indicates the relation, and this says at the same time that we are able to absorb such numbers.
I read this morning that some newspapers in East Germany are blaming the Western media for inciting people to move. You mentioned a couple times in your speech the role of the media, the Western media specifically, in the entire situation.
There is no hint for that. That is their propaganda. They have really no answer to the problem. And when you see how they try to invent every day new reproaches to West Germany, that's ridiculous. The wave is really put into march in Eastern Germany. The problem is there and not caused by the Western side.
You were talking about Hungary and how Hungary to the East Germans is the Mediterranean, and visa restrictions are being put on West East Germans heading to Hungary. Can you talk maybe a bit about what's going on behind the scenes between Hungary and East Germany, because Hungary now having opened their border to Austria?
Not very much. The foreign secretary of Hungary went to East Berlin before they opened the border, and that was an icy talk, and he came back and said it's pointless to talk with the East Germans, we have to go our way. And of course the Hungarians are now hoping that with this liberal attitude they are having new money from the West, of course, that's in there. But one is hesitant to combine the 2 points. But Hungary is in a very shaky position. Things can go in both directions. They have now a liberal system there since 2 years. The forecast for the economy for this year were not too bad, but it is a catastrophical situation of the Hungarian economy. Their per capita debts are higher than in Poland. That is very often forgotten in the West. The credit demand of Hungary is unbelievable high.
What do you foresee for East Germany in the next few years?
I am hesitant to think in terms of years, because the developments we see this year are so speeding up. I think a very critical moment will come next spring, when the greater part of the East Germans have to realize that they have no any longer even a modest right to travel, that Hungary, Czechoslovakia are bad, that they have to stay at home. That will be a conflict-loaden moment.
And what about, how do you think the East German government is dealing now with the refugees, how they will deal in the next few months?
The West German government?
The East German government.
They will try to close the borders completely. But for me, it's an open question whether they can be successful, because the stream of refugees will now go away from Czechoslovakia into Poland. And for the GDR, it's very difficult to control the border to Poland. Mm-hmm. It's a barbed wire border, but not to compare with the western border towards western Germany. So there are holes in it to escape. And what I hear is that overnight hundreds of people are still going through Hungary, so it seems that there are ways to go out of GDR, and that is, from their point of view, not tolerable.
And reunification, you mentioned earlier, not even a question.
Not even a question. You can like certain developments, you can hope that they will occur. But the Honecker regime, if it wants to survive, must have 100% command of the power. Giving away 10% only means already incalculable risks. And at the same time, 18 Russian divisions are in GDR. And the GDR for the Soviet Union these days, even the days of Gorbachev, is the only guarantee of the survival of the empire, the last colonial empire of the world.
Guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren. Heute Abend sprechen wir mit Jochen Thies. this feature is 7 minutes 49 seconds long. It's Kim Trainer and myself talking to Jochen Thies on the topic of West Germany. The date is October the 13th, a Friday. Friday the 13th, 1989.
This is the Voice of Reason from November the 24th, 89, with Norm Hermont and Simon Cridland.
Welcome to the Voice of Reason, supplying the opinions you need and the opinions you should have. I'm Simon Cridland, and with me is Norman Hermont.
Thanks, Simon. We're going to start off the Voice of Reason this particular Friday afternoon, dealing with those wacky and kooky events in El Salvador. Boy, that place is looking pretty bad, Simon.
I know, Norm, but you're always looking at the bad side. You have to look at the good side as well. Here we have a hotel full of tourists experiencing live, exciting wartime action right up front. I mean, Norm, for years people have been going to Africa for the safari, for the excitement and everything, but now with all the elephants dying, there has to be an alternative spot, and I think El Salvador is where it's at.
You may be right, Simon. Maybe rebel warfare is the new elephant of the 1990s, if you will. Maybe this is a trend. I mean, you know, those American soldiers were on the fourth floor. Okay, you had rebels on the third and the fifth, but imagine the fun there. I mean, you got rebels above you, rebels below you. You still got room service. You can have your club sandwich.
Well, you know, I can't understand these Americans. They're always whining, you know, just because they can't get to the pool 24 hours a day. They're complaining, you know, calling in the Green Berets for what?
I couldn't agree with you more. Military force because you can't get to the heated pool, you know, when you're staying in a hotel. Come on, George Bush, what's going on? I mean, for that kind of excitement, I'd pay top dollar. Top dollar? Hey, I'd pay top ruble for that kind of fun, Simon. So, you know, speaking of top ruble.
Oh, yeah, Brian Mulroney in Russia. What a great media event there, Norm.
He seems to have really captured the imagination of the Soviet people. I know it's one of the biggest visits to Moscow that they've had in decades, with Brian Mulroney being there. It's big news.
Well, you know, the people of Canada, the people of Russia looking together at this great super summit. You know, it's surprising the world has been able to hold together these past 18 years when we didn't have a visit between Canada and the Soviet Union.
Well, I know there was some concern expressed at the United Nations just recently that these two great powers should come together and meet. And, you know, it's funny, some of the things you don't really notice. I know when we were there in Moscow just a few days ago reporting on the summit, we noticed definitely there's Mila Mulroney mania in Moscow, Mila mania. In fact, I went up to a number of Moscovites and asked them in Russian, what do you think of the visit? And a lot of them were heard to say the famous Russian expression, Mushka Milyashki. Mushka Milyashki, which roughly translated means, who the hell is Mila Mulroney? So obviously there's been a big effect there on the Russian people.
Well, definitely, Norm. In fact, this summit has been coined the summit of the 80s, you know, the summit to top off the 80s. It's just a bit sad that it was timed so badly, being upstaged as it is by the visit next week of the Prime Minister of Swaziland.
Well, I mean, that's to be understood, Simon. I mean, there's going to be some very major Swazi-Soviet affairs talked about there, and there's some strategic concerns, you know, about Swaziland.
Well, I guess if Canada really wanted world stage, they would have scheduled the visit differently and not had the Swazi visit so close to the Canadian visit.
Or they would have at least redone Mila's hair before they went there, or something to draw a little attention for themselves.
Definitely. Anyhow, we'll be back in a moment.
Stress. It's getting to you. Life gets more and more hectic. At work, at the office, at home. But wait.
There's Lebanon. Beautiful Lebanon. Jewel of the Mediterranean.
Neglected for decades by vacation travelers, this paradise awaits you. A land of excitement, of enchantment, a land of bullets.
A land of the green line, a land of lighted skies as tracers dart across the night sky.
Imagine you eating your romantic candlelight dinner as the clatter of AK-47s fires through the night background.
Lebanon, for more information on this important and exciting travel opportunity, call Critlin Travel.
Lebanon. For $17.95, don't let this exciting possibility slip away.
Undertaker's insurance included.
We're back at the Voice of Reason, and Simon, how about those whiners at Capilano College?
Do these people have a problem or what? For the first time in years, they're going to have a Christmas without the specter of exams hanging over their heads, and they're complaining?
Oh, wow, gee, that would really upset me. No exams at Christmas?
Yeah, really. I mean, I would kill for no exams. Anyhow, I guess to each his own.
Well, that's just about wraps it up for today's program. So for Simon Cridlin and Norma Hermont, this has been
The Voice of Reason.
This is a very long interview with Ken McIntyre, past president of the Naval Officers Association of BC, by Dorita Fong. It was done in November for Radioactive Nuclear Free Vancouver. 1989.
Who you are?
Alrighty. Well, let's see now. The Naval Officers Association of British Columbia was formed in 1919 and it's comprised of former commissioned serving officers of the Canadian and Commonwealth and Allied Navies. We're allied with a younger organization that was formed immediately following the Second World War, the Naval Officers Association of Canada, which comprises some 3,000 members spread from coast to coast. Again, all former naval officers. And our principal intent, I guess, is to foster the naval service, the aims and purposes of the naval service, because quite obviously a naval-serving person cannot make a political comment, cannot express an opinion while serving. But those of us who have served and are now civilians again have the opportunity of voicing our concerns and criticisms of things that we have seen during the time we were serving. That's who we are.
Okay, great. Could you tell us specifically what your aims are, the organization's aims?
Well, when I say fostering the aims of the naval service, we believe, because of our own experience, that Canada needs a navy, an effective navy, a modern navy, a navy that can fulfill any requirement that the politicians of our country so dictate.
Great, thanks. Okay, and who specifically are you?
I'm the immediate past president of NOABC. I served, had the honor to serve amongst most illustrious people for the period, 1984 through to 1988.
Okay, right, then now we get into questions. What has been the role of NATO in the world since it was formed?
Well, I believe, as do my colleagues, that NATO has been the instrument that has given us essentially 45 years of world peace. When you look at NATO, there is a tendency today to consider it just to be this big monolithic element, and people who are not aware of how it came into being see it probably as one of the major saber rattlers on the world scene. There is this image that the Warsaw Pact on one side and NATO on the other are the two forces which perhaps could drag us into another world conflict, when in fact, I believe that NATO is the force that has kept us at peace.
Would you qualify NATO as being peacekeepers or war preventers? So what I'm asking you is that this peace we've had for the last 45 years, would you qualify that as being peace or lack of war?
No, definitely peace, because if you go back to the circumstances under which NATO was created, now, most people, for example, don't understand that Canada was one of the principal instigators of NATO. As a matter of fact, it was Uncle Louis Saint-Laurent, who was then external affairs minister, who made the suggestion that Canada and 14 other Western nations should form an alliance to contain Soviet expansionism as was seen immediately following the Second World War.
Okay.
You know, it goes hand in hand with the declaration of the Truman Doctrine. And people would say, well, what was that and who was he? And why would Harry Truman make such a statement? But unless you get into all of the details that follow through, say, from Yalta and Potsdam and Stalin's attempt to exert his influence through the Balkans to the Mediterranean and Britain's necessity to withdraw from that region due to austerity in 1947 and so on, although the Americans, as I understand it, were initially very reluctant to participate in European affairs, it became obvious that when Stalin would not honor his promises that he had made at Yalta, that Truman, the new president who took over when Roosevelt died, Truman found it necessary to make a statement to the effect that the United States would offer assistance to any country, communist or non-communist, that would resist the expansion or the extension of Soviet control over territory. The United States, at that time, enunciated the fact that it was quite willing to see communism prevail in those countries which, in 1947, were under Soviet control. But the Soviets, Stalin in particular, seemed to have other ideas. And out of Stalin's push came the resistance to that push, which was NATO. And from NATO's work, I believe, as we said, we've had peace.
Okay. Would you comment on what you think the significance of the coming down of the Berlin Wall is?
Oh, my goodness. We've probably seen, as most everyone else has said, the most earth-shattering events of the last half century. And the speed, the rapidity with which this has taken place is just boggling in terms of all of those who have studied international relationships. One would expect, perhaps, that things would move along quietly and orderly, but what we've had here is just a massive overthrow of established government control. And you can perhaps get into the economics, the necessity for such an overthrow to take place as rapidly as it has, but I don't believe many of us in the West ever anticipated it happening with the speed that it has.
Would you say then that the world climate has changed significantly and permanently?
Oh boy, yes. Yes, indeed. In the last 4 years, we've had an acknowledgement, remarkably since the time of Chernobyl. Chernobyl itself seems to have been the big turning point when the Soviets were compelled to reveal to the world some of the problems that they did have. It seems to have snowballed from that point that there is an acknowledgement of the shortages of the economic chaos in the Soviet states and the necessity. You know, it's not a case that you could say that Gorbachev has come out of the woodwork with a great idea, new idea, revolutionary idea. These are all ideas that have been used in the Soviet Union since the time of the revolution of 1917. They've been tried and put aside and so on. But Gorbachev was faced with the necessity of restructuring the economy so that the Soviet people themselves would not revolt against the government, as they obviously were on the verge of doing.
Do you think the perestroika and glasnost are definite reasons for thinking that things are changing?
Absolutely. What we have to do, however, is to look to see exactly how things are changing. The restructuring is economic more than political. The politics, I believe, have essentially followed along with the economics. But you realize how the various states within the Soviet Union now are exerting their own desire for autonomy. It's my understanding that that desire has always been there, just under the surface, that most of the non-Russian Soviet states were not at all happy to be ensnarled in the web, as it were. And now that there is the opportunity to exert their own autonomy, they certainly are striving to do so.
Okay, thanks. Do you think that NATO still has a role in the world when the Warsaw Pact is either crumbling or being dismantled from within? And actually, first, could you answer the question of whether you think the Warsaw Pact is crumbling or whether it's being taken down by the people within it?
No, I don't think the Warsaw Pact as such is crumbling at all. One of the linchpins of the Soviet economy is the necessity to keep a phenomenal number of men under arms, to keep them in the army. Also, there is an economy devoted towards the production of munitions and so on. Without that element within the Soviet economy, I don't think the Soviet economy would persist even in the state that it's in. A tremendous amount of dedication goes towards the maintenance of the military behind the so-called Red Curtain.
Well, it does seem, though, that with the various summit meetings, Gorbachev has been offering to dismantle the arms and to demilitarize. Couldn't this be a time for trust when we could say that NATO doesn't have a role anymore in the world, that we could disarm multilaterally, because it wouldn't be a matter of being unilaterally disarming?
No, and that also brings up the nastiness of nuclear weapons. You see, if you have, in this most simplistic of terms, if you have two pawns and I have one, and you say, well, I'll cut my arms by half. I'll throw out one of my pawns. What do I throw out? If I throw out my one remaining pawn, I have no pawns. And you have the only the only piece of any value. And so when the Soviet bloc says, well, we will reduce our military commitment by 300,000 men, we expect the West to do the same. Well, they're still left with several millions, and 300,000 essentially takes all that is in the West. And that's why the perceived necessity of stating, we do not have enough men, we do not balance you in men, material, airplanes, or tanks, but we do have the bomb, and we would be loath to use the bomb. Now, I'm sort of fantasizing words that were spoken 40 years ago, but the West has the bomb, and the only thing that we have to keep you from sweeping towards the Atlantic Ocean is the threat of the first use of the bomb. Now, obviously, that never came to pass because there was respect on both sides for that. And, of course, the Soviet Union also had the bomb by 1949. And it was that possession that has given us the peace, that the Soviets have had, the Warsaw Pact has had those troops on the eastern side of the line. The Western countries have not had the same number of troops on the West, a very, very small number of troops on the West, really, by comparison. But the awareness that the retaliatory capability was there is thought by many analysts to have been the reason that we've had the peace that we have.
Well, you have a good simile there of peace being like a chess game with the pawns. However, I think there's something definitely different about the nature of nuclear weapons, in that if one side has a nuclear weapons and they use it, it's also a matter of harming themselves. Don't you think that that we can afford to disarm unilaterally? Because even if they have nuclear weapons and they use them, it will not only destroy the countries of the NATO Pact, but of the NATO alliance, but also the countries of the Warsaw Pact.
That's a very valid point. All same on the beach scenario. And I think that's been given a great deal of thought. But the statement made by the West that we have a retaliatory capability in terms of nuclear weapons, i.e. to the Soviets, you must be aware of this. And you must be aware that we would go down the tube as you would go down the tube if either one of us used it. So let's not be foolish enough to think that you can exert your control politically, militarily, over these countries that Stalin supposedly felt were necessary to maintain his isolationism and border security. I would like to think, because I personally do not endorse the use of force of any sort, for that matter, particularly the atom bomb, I believe that there had to be an awareness. It was a case that, again, a simple analogy. I've got this great big stick that I don't intend to use, but I carry this great big stick because you and your friends might have two bigger sticks that you'll beat me with. I'm not paying attention. It's a case of a total case of not trusting each other, and it's a case of who can be the first to trust.
Well, wouldn't this be a time for trust, though? The kind of political change we are seeing, though, wouldn't it be reasonable to say that if I put down my stick, then maybe you could do the same thing?
It
wouldn't benefit either side to use nuclear weapon, the stick, whatever you want to call it.
That's absolutely true, but for heaven's sake, how do I express myself in terms of this dilemma? Maybe it's the old machismo thing that you have two young boys squaring off, and there's a lot of posturing and positioning that takes place. Neither one intends to, but on a reality scale, the real scenario is such that either country intended to do so. And I don't believe that one country or the other can lay down, put your head in the sand, and ignore the possibility that will come about from the other. I don't believe that it actually can occur that way. You know, this is real world politics we're talking about now. We're not talking nice people on either side. We're talking about individuals who have principle, and I put that in quotation marks, whatever that means. And they believe, you know, the old expression that we had in the 50s, better red than dead, or better dead than red, however you might see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it possible that you put it... that...
We can go
if
around
we don't
it.
Disarm, are we imperiling the world? If, for instance, the... if the Warsaw Pact is coming apart, and if Gorbachev is sincere in his offers of unilateral disarmament, aren't we imperiling the world if we decide that we will not disarm?
No, I don't think so, because the West has shown that it is not about to use the bomb. The threat is there that it will use the bomb if provoked, but if it's not provoked, the West obviously will not use it. It will rust in peace.
But isn't there this problem that we could have nuclear accidents where we, it's not simply like a stick, but it's like having a loaded gun in your pocket. If you trip, you could kill yourself.
Yes, you would trip and kill yourself if you had a loaded gun in your pocket, but I'm not one of those who subscribe to the idea that there are loaded and ready nuclear weapons to go off at a moment's notice. Even during the really intense period of the Cold War, the aircraft of Strategic Air Command that flew constantly with nuclear weapons aboard flew with unarmed nuclear weapons. When I say unarmed, they were not not primed for detonation. They had to be mechanically activated before they could be used. And so it's the case of the hunter now who goes into the field with an unloaded gun and loads his gun at the prospect of the target is not likely to fall over and shoot himself, whereas the idiot who walks around with a loaded gun probably will. And I would like to believe that notwithstanding the comments made by some of the environmentalists and the anti-defense activists, that the individuals with their fingers on the trigger, and I personally have met and spoken with many of these individuals whose fingers are on the trigger, are very reasonable, very, very principled individuals, again, who are just not sort of raving maniacs with the Dr. Strangelove scenario.
So you did mention something about individuals with fingers on the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that they could be, even if the majority of people are principled and decent people, isn't there this possibility that those who have the fingers on the trigger could cause our destruction because of the nature of nuclear bombs?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so in the sense that the individuals, as I understand it, that go in to the military, devote themselves to the concept that they are, and most, again, anti-defense groups would not have us believe this, that they are controlled by the politicians. And the politicians, whether this be true or not, are supposedly the voice of the people. And so your ultimate serving person, and that's where the term service comes from, is that your military people are directly beholden to the public. It's not the other way around. Terms like the military-industrial complex and so on are really inflammatory in that sense. But our peacekeeping troops, as I believe the peacekeeping troops of the United States and of Russia and so on, are responsible to the people.
Do you personally feel that we have embarked on a time of real-world peace as opposed to its being the Cold War?
I believe so. I would like to believe so. I hope so.
Okay. And have you ever been personally involved in any NATO activities?
Yes. In the early 1950s, I served in, believe it or not, in the Royal Canadian Air Force, even though I'm in the Naval Officers Association. I served at 3 Fighter Wing in Zweibrücken in Germany. At that time, Canada had four fighter wings of the best aircraft in Western Europe. We flew the F-86 Sabres, and we were acknowledged to be, the Royal Canadian Air Force was acknowledged to be the frontline defense against the Soviets. And it was a real-world experience for us. We believed that we were doing something vital for peace.
Okay, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Okay, and if you want to listen to the broadcast, did you hear the one last week?
Yes, I caught it.
Oh, what did you think?
I was very impressed.
Oh, good.
I truly was.
Oh, good. Okay.
I didn't agree with everything that was said, and I was fascinated in a couple of the statements that were made, how the actual background political bias was revealed where it did show up that it wasn't just a plain and simple case that we want to get rid of these nasty things. you were very perceptive, and you hit the nail right on the head.
Okay, so this one is going to be broadcast same time again this week.
Well, be as kind as you can, will you?
Okay, thanks very much for taking your time to speak to us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is James Burke on Hypermedia in Universities, recorded at a press conference on October the 3rd. And these are just raw clips of the press conference, all strung together. Kim Trainer and myself were the reporters. And it's 5 minutes and 00 seconds long.
We have a Channel 5, which is a knowledge network, and we can have university courses through television. How do you see that can be, if the role of television in this interaction, do you think that would replace the university, say?
It would go a long way to replacing it for people who don't live near one, for example.
Right, well, that's what it is for now, for people in the interior who can't reach the university.
I mean, I don't mean geographically near one, I mean also, you know, socially near one. I mean, there are lots of what's fashionably called the underclass who live a long way from the university, even if they're next door to it. So there's lots of ways in which I think that those limitations could ideally be broken down.
But don't you think that could also remove the human aspect of actual interaction with the professor or with other students?
I think that's a comfortable middle class thing to say, if you don't mind me saying so. A lot of people would give anything to hell with the personal
just
interaction,
to have the courses,
just to get themselves a university education,
right,
then get on with the human interaction.
Mm-hmm.
That's a temporary remark I'm making. I mean, I would ideally see it as a transition period beyond which the machines provide the data that you feel you need for whatever it is you want to qualify at.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, I mean, I went to Oxford where they had this weird medieval thing called a moral tutor. Nothing to do with morals. I mean, nobody gave a rat's ass about your morals. But there was a person in the college to whom you could go at any time and say whatever you want to say.
Right.
I mean, nobody ever did, but it was there.
Well, we have that too.
Yeah. So that's there always. And maybe that role would be augmented.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the other side of getting this stuff to the people who haven't got it.
Well, because right now a large majority of students who would want to go to university can't afford to, or
right,
it's just too expensive,
yeah,
so I can see it being important.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of personal interaction thing is a luxury that you can afford only when you've been through stage one, which is actually getting yourself a degree at this stage, for the underprivileged.
So what do you see happening after that stage?
I don't know. That's too far away.
Okay.
I don't know whether we'll get degree qualifications at all anymore. What becomes a concern in the long run, of course, is the social implications of being able to have machines that work like that. And I'm a physicist. I'd like to believe that, you know, what you do is you educate the franchise, and only then do you have a truly participatory democracy in which people are daily involved in the process of a sort of consensus taking about what the machines ought to be doing for us from day to day, week to week, day to day. And you don't need qualifications to do that. You just need a sense of what the community needs. But that's the other side of a really major educational revolution. Fantasy.
Computers are currently very, very good at processing information and doing the math that humans are not terribly good at, and at the moment, at any rate, they're terrible at intuitive thinking. And do you see a point where the computers are doing all of what are at the moment seen as sort of maintenance, lower class jobs, and humans are all what sort of sitting in universities and thinking and creating and doing what computers can.
I don't know what they're doing or where they're sitting, but it would be nice if that were true. And the Industrial Revolution at a lower level did that sort of thing. It said they won't be heaving anymore. Steam engines will be heaving. And there we are, lo and behold, we survived and we just stopped heaving and the steam engines heaved. So yes, it would be nice. But I don't know about machines thinking. I think there's a lot of nonsense talked about artificial intelligence these days, about the fact that machines will think. I mean, somebody said to me the other day from Stanford said, who's in the lab there, he said his favorite phrase is that when people talk about intelligent machines, he says, did you know that the cognitive level of the most powerful supercomputer on Earth approximates to that of the flatworm? And they all go, oh, no, really. You know, it's a long, long way from that to this.
So then you see...
Never mind language, let's not get into that.
So you see computers sort of continuing their role as research assistants, if you like, and we do the actual...
I would hope so, yes.
Actual sort of imagining and thinking that goes on.
Very clever research assistants. I mean, even at the moment, the expert systems, you know, at a baby level, are saying clever things about it, saying, well, it looks to me like this. I would suggest that this is what your problem you've got.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want me to do about it? Or My assessment of what's down there is that there's probably hydrocarbon, but there's also this and this. Now, what do you think? And then people with experience are doing it with them, say, yeah. But increasingly, that experience is being fed too. But that's pretty sort of low-level stuff. That's sea spot run stuff.
Why do you think the changes, or similar changes to ones you're fantasizing about now, are inevitable, or do you think our existing structures, which one senses you would see in some ways as holding us back, do in fact have the ability to put a stop to, do you think, and could in fact damage us irreparably?
Well, I mean, people like Daniel Bell are very pessimistic about it. They say, you know, two-class society, informed elite, leisured serfs. It isn't going to be easy, I don't think. I mean, there are a lot of institutional vested interests that would be a lot less comfortable if this came to that. I mean, a lot of my confreres in the teaching system in England would really hate hypermedia in the classroom because it would really test them. I do an awful lot of work to keep up with that stuff. I once had I suppose this illustrates my answer as good as it could be. I once had a long session with a fellow called Petrov, who was running the Russian space effort, back in the days when I was covering Apollo for the Soyuz people, you know, for the BBC. And we did a long interview, and America was getting to the moon any day now, and I jokingly said, you know, you should have bought American computers, they would have brought you to the moon faster. And he said, they make us think like Americans, and we don't want that. And then he said, I have a nightmare. He said that one day this country will get, and then he used the phrase, which in those days, I can't remember what it was, but today would mean PC. And he said, the day we get PCs, that's a nightmare I don't want to face.
This is a promo that, not a promo, never mind. This is a feature that Luke Dinsdale and Chris DeWinitz did on the AMS Computer Fair on October the 15th in the sub ballroom. And it's got a couple of false starts, and the length is 4 minutes and 30 seconds, about. Year? Oh, the year is 1989.
The music you're hearing sounds like an LP, but it's actually coming from a computer. The computer, the Next, was displayed at last week's AMS Computer Fest here at UBC, along with a truck full of others. Over 20 companies were showing off their products to the crowd of students, professors, and local business people. They had everything from the biggest and brightest high-intensity multiple-dimension monitor displays to the smallest circuit breakers. As expected, IBM, Apple, and Next had the biggest displays at the show. IBM had their latest computer out on display, the new PS2 Model 70. This computer features the brand new 8486 microchip from Intel. This microchip is about the size of your thumb and can execute over 10 million commands per second. Of course, the model costs over $8,000 and wouldn't be practical for any student or household. IBM suggests if you're interested in purchasing a computer, their models 25 or 30 would do the trick. These smaller, more compact models, featuring huge amounts of memory and awesome graphics capabilities, and cost about $1,500. Good deal, if you ask me.
In an attempt to compete in today's rapidly developing portable computer market, Apple Computers has recently developed the Macintosh Portable. This long-awaited member of the Macintosh family is the latest in portable computer technology. With its standard 1.4 megabyte internal drive, operating at a speed of 16 megahertz, this portable is twice as fast as the Macintosh SE, which many of us are already familiar with. Accompanying its convenient size and weight, a little more than a foot square and about 14 pounds respectively, are a number of advanced features, such as an impressive liquid crystal display, built-in trackball, and rechargeable battery. This Macintosh Portable is available through the UBC bookstore, though a wait should be expected, as they are in very high demand. Another point of interest for loyal Macintosh users is a new video card, which allows the Macintosh to be used with displays heretofore reserved for the PC world. This card, developed by Lapis Technologies, is aptly called Display Server, and allows the Mac SE and 2 to be used with a number of PC displays, ranging from small monochrome screens to full-size color displays. According to Lapis Marketing Director Bill Ford, this new card will save those currently using a high-priced PC display from investing in a special monitor when they convert to Macintosh hardware. Fortunately, for those students on a tight budget, this card is expected to sell for under half of what similar adapters are currently worth.
Finally, the next, Steve Jobs' latest hit, is probably the most amazing computer on the market. This computer features the best of both the IBM and the Macintosh worlds. Fast, concise calculations, and the graphical grace and sound quality of a Macintosh. The next contains a 480/60, another high-speed chip from Motorola, and gives the computer high-intensity graphics along with incredible memory capabilities. The next has enough memory to contain the complete Webster's Dictionary, the most complex chess program, and the complete works of Shakespeare all at once. Its optical disc hard drive can contain more than 500 Vancouver phone directories, and its hard laser disc technology enables it to digitize music like this. At 15 grand though, I'm not sure if it's worth the price. For CITR News, I'm Luke Dinstall with Chris DeWinitz.
This interview was taped around the 22nd of June, 1989. It's an interview with Tao, that's his first name. He's a Chinese student from Beijing University studying at UBC. It's 8 minutes and 29 seconds long, and it's me doing the interview. Okay, tape rolling. It is the 22nd. Of June 1989, and I'm speaking to Tao, and there was a press conference coming up at 2 o'clock, the Chinese students' representatives from BC universities and colleges. Tao, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
You're a student from China who's now, are you studying at UBC now?
Yeah, I'm studying computer science.
Okay, and how long have you been in Vancouver?
9 months.
And you're a student from where in China?
Beijing University.
Okay. So before we get into the details of the press conference, let's talk a bit about what is happening in China now. Do you know some of the students then that were involved in the protest? Obviously, you probably do, but how about the ones on the most wanted list?
Oh, two of my friends are among the most wanted student leaders list.
And have you had any contact at all since the protest?
No. I guess they have gone underground after the massacre.
What do you fear will happen? Do you think they'll be found? Or do you think they'll be able to get out of China?
Well, right now, I don't think they can get out of China, but maybe they can hide somewhere, like in somewhere in the embassies.
If they're anywhere in China right now, is there the fear that someone in the street will identify them and phone one of these hotlines?
Yeah, that's right. Because of many, many plainclothes police in China, all other places.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about here in Canada? As a Chinese student, there was a TV report about anonymous phone calls to Chinese students warning them. And you were mentioning before we started the interview that the Chinese intelligence reports that they're sending people to North America. Is this part of the governmental propaganda, or do you really believe that they were sending people to look for students?
Yeah, I believe that the government has or will send intelligence agents to North America to sort of intimidate at least overseas Chinese students.
You haven't had anybody threaten you yet, have you?
Not yet.
Do you feel safe in Canada?
Yeah, I feel fairly safe in Canada, but I still worried about after the intelligence agents come, they have special missions. No one knows what's their mission.
Mm-hmm. We were talking before we started the interview about the propaganda tool that the government with the television and how they're spreading the message. And the fact that most people in Beijing from the gunfire and just by being a witness would know what is really happening. And would not the communication between people in Beijing and the rest of the country eventually spread the truth, no matter how much of the government propaganda is spread by the television?
Yeah, that's right. People will eventually know the truth by talking to each other. And that's, as a matter of fact, for a long time, that's the way of getting news in China. People don't really believe in newspapers or TVs. They trust a so-called 小道消息, more than the government propaganda. 小道消息 means small lane news, as compared to highway news, the propaganda machine.
So you're saying there's a difference in the way they report with events that affect the security of the country. They will pop out more lies.
Yeah, that's right. They don't care. You see, if they tell lies, they always tell lies. Actually,
there have been reports that the Chinese government is monitoring all incoming calls from outside as fax lines and regular phone lines and all communication. That's pretty hard to believe. I'm sure that couldn't even be done in North America if they tried. Is that another one of the government's?
Yeah, sure. Threat? That's the truth. Because a friend of mine called his sister, and when they started to talk about the massacre in Beijing, the line was cut down. Obviously, the operator was monitoring their conversation.
But do you think that they can monitor all of the calls coming in?
Well, it's possible. I don't think there will be a technical problem. They have technical problem. Yeah, I think that's possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's let's get to the press conference. It's at 2 o'clock today, but when we broadcast this, it will have happened. But give us some of the details as to what some of the topics you will be addressing are.
We'd like to reveal in the past how the Chinese government's violate human rights, basic human rights in China. And we'll discuss the mass arrests and execution of student leaders as well as work union leaders in China. And we are especially concerned about the Canadian government's reaction towards the massacre and mass arrests in China. We also concerned about the Canadian government's policy on Chinese nationals, Chinese students in Canada. We expect Canadian government to let us stay in Canada until it's safe to go home.
Could you reiterate that? You're saying the government right now is allowing you to stay in Canada.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you think that won't go on forever is what you're saying?
Well, we hope the government will stick to their promises.
Do you think it will ever be safe, in quotations, to go back to China? Even Hong Kong is now fearing when it gets turned over from its status as a British colony. And that's years away yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, and listen, right now I can't see any hope for China to be a safe place to go.
How long would it be before you felt safe to go back to China? If, let's say, that the executions that we're seeing, and all of a sudden there are no more executions, it seems everything's returning to normal, at least it seems like that, would you go back to China?
No, that's only in the surface, you know. They still have thousands or possibly millions of political prisoners, and they have discrimination towards intellectuals. As you see, if someone has a high degree, he will be treated as a bad element of the society.
Interesting. I should mention that if our listeners want to get more information on visa extensions and how to get refugee status for Chinese students at UBC, that is available through the UBC's Alma Mater Society External Affairs Coordinator, Vanessa Geary, and her phone number here on campus, if you're interested, is 228-2050. And if you miss that number or want more information, you can also contact us at CITR. We can pass on whatever we have here. Tao, thanks for joining me. Best of luck. And is there anything else you wanted to add before leaving us today?
No.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you again.
Well, that's it for the tape.
You're Ian Gunn.
I'm Ian Gunn. And you're Stefan Ellis.
And come on, Kim, step up to the microphone.
I'm Kim Trader.
We're three individuals that in the year of 1989 and now 1990 have spent a lot of time at the station. And we hope that you've reached this part of the tape.
Consider it's January 1st, 1990, and we're here.
It's late. It's, what, 20 after 6. We're not supposed to be here. It's New Year's Day.
But if you've made it this far and you're listening to this tape, we're probably not here.
So thanks very much, and keep up the good work, and we'll be listening to the 102.